So the way we normally start is to make sure, because this is indeed radio,
yes,
that we have the right band in the room.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is not a room that I've ever been in before. Mm-hmm. So not only is the room a mystery, but the band is even worse, or worser, depending on how you talk.
Right.
So would you please all identify yourselves to start out?
Okay. My name is Fred Pinot, and I was the lead guitarist for the Atlantics.
You were.
Well, I am.
You remember, this is an interview with the Atlantics. So we have to keep it in the present tense.
Okay, let me...
pretend.
Here we go. I'm Fred Pinot, and I'm the lead guitarist for the Atlantics.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Houck, and I'm the other guitarist for the Atlantics.
I'm Ray Fernandes, and I'm the drummer for the Atlantics.
Let's do the Mad Libs, the Mad Libs bio thang. Take it away, Tom. They're all pointing at you.
I'll cover that part of it, if I may. In 1975, Bruce Wilkinson and I were both at Tufts University in Boston, and we decided to start a band. And I'll cut a lot of the detail out. And Bruce recruited his friend Bobby Marin from New Jersey, a high school friend, to come up to Boston to join the band. We had Jeff Locke and Bobby Bear to round us out, and we started playing our first shows in the early spring of 76 when I was a senior at Tufts.
What was the name of the band back then?
The band was the Atlantics. Oh, no, we emerged, you know, full-blown,
wow.
You know, basically in our more or less final appearance and kind of format. And this was during a very exciting period in pop music when all kinds of new bands were coming up, and there was a perception among young people, including ourselves, that the music industry was controlled by fossilized, out-of-touch, superstar sort of performers who really didn't have any kind of street credibility or connection with young people. And so all these new bands sprang up. The Ramones, Television, Talking Heads, Atlantics, you know, Real Kids, the Neighborhoods. It all happened at once. And the kind of environment was that anything went as long as you were creative. And that was really important. So you had bands like the Atlantics who wore suits and ties, because we were sort of emulating 1964-era Rolling Stones, which is who we looked up to.
Your raison d'etre.
Exactly. Or, you know, or the Ramones, or Thunder Train, or, you know, Willie Loco, all these guys. They were all doing different things, but we were all part of the same scene because we were all sort of disgusted with what we thought was the lack
of
creativity.
Time.
It was a horrible, horrible time.
Yeah, that was just pre-disco and just post really bad top 40.
Disco was
bad top 40.
Yes.
We used to call it Teflon.
We used
rock.
To if you listen to the radio then, you were grateful to hear Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Yes.
Because it resembled actual rock and roll.
It was like Nice to Be With You by Gallery and all of those. You remember all these terrible
Horowitz Magic.
Yeah. Yes, right. Pilot stuff. Magic. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And so we, from the beginning, Bobby and Bruce and I were determined to sort of emulate the kind of early 1960s pop music kind of values that we thought were great. Short songs, songs about teenage experiences, simple music, the same kind of values that a lot of other musicians were sort of going for at the same time.
So you were signed to MCA, he said, doing a smooth segue.
You're jumping through a lot of stuff.
Yes, I am.
And the first format of the band didn't quite work out.
Right.
We were lucky enough to acquire Fred Pinot on lead guitar and then Ray Fernandes on the drums. But bringing Fred and Ray into the band really made us sound like what we always wanted to sound like. And so we were then, at that point, ready to go. And indeed, we got signed to ABC Records.
That's right.
Which promptly was sold to
MCA. Right.
We were caught up in this kind of, you know...
That's true, because my original is on ABC. That's right, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
But the singles... Did a single ever come out on ABC?
Yes. No, not on MCA. It's on
it
MCA.
Came out on MCA, the
blue
label.
There was
yeah.
a 7-inch and a 12-inch single that came out
right.
on MCA.
Right, right.
But we were caught almost immediately in sort of a cultural war. Our producer was a guy named John Stronach from Los Angeles. And we had a rehearsal with him before we did the album at the Hit Factory in New York. And we ran through our songs. And he said, okay, boys, what kind of artists do you like to listen to? And we said, you know, Elvis Costello, the Ramones, the Talking Heads, Blondie.
Pretenders.
Sex Pistols.
And he said, quote, you guys will sound like the Eagles of the New Wave.
I'm sorry.
And we...
There's something in my throat.
So were we.
Sorry.
And so at that point, we realized that we had a serious kind of communication problem or a cultural problem because we really had a direction that we were going in. And clearly, Mr. Stronach was coming from a different kind of area. But we you know, we forged ahead, did the album. The album came out. We're proud of the songs. We're proud of the performances. The production, of course, there's some issues with that. But we were lucky enough to then go on a major national tour with Roxy Music because their album Manifesto had just come out, and they were touring the U.S. from east to west. And so we hooked up with Premier Talent and we're off with Roxy Music, which was a great experience and was really just fantastic for us.
What was in the water then? Because Boston, maybe it's because I was here for those 6 years, but I could have named another 20 bands.
It was amazing.
That was an amazing, you know, amazing. Maybe it's drugs that I'm still on. I don't know. But
you know
to
what?
Me,
I think one huge factor is the fact that for many English bands, Boston is the first concert stop on their first trip to America, generally the Paradise or the Channel. Mm-hmm. And so you would see Elvis Costello, U2, bands like that.
So the influences were
first,
there.
Their first U.S. shows would be in Boston. So if you were a Boston musician or a Boston artist and you had some awareness of what was going on, you had contact with these other artists immediately. Mm. If you were living in Indianapolis or, you know, Cincinnati, it would take you years even to figure out who they were.
So,
And it validates what you're doing. Because you think, okay, great, there are people doing what I'm doing. This is, you know, I'm not a fool for trying to write original music or whatever I'm doing.
Right.
So it's a community. The community was very, very strong. There's New York, only a couple hours away. My first trip to New York was in 1975. I went to a nightclub called Mother's with Bruce over Thanksgiving weekend. We saw Talking Heads play for about 20 people. We met Danny Fields, who was the Ramones manager at that point, and he said, isn't this amazing? It's great what's happening. And, of course, who knows what was happening? It was this tiny little thing.
Nobody even knew.
No one even knew, but it was happening. And we went back with Danny, and he played us some Ramones tapes. And but clearly there was a community forming, and being Boston, New York, London, that axis was very potent. Mm.
After MCA, lots of songs from the Atlantics released on tape only.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
No money to press the record.
Well, wait a minute. No, the first thing that Lonely Hearts came out on a single.
Right.
No, I know that. But that came out, and that just really hit. At least here it did.
Yeah. It did. It did.
I mean, massively.
We were very grateful and very thrilled.
You could not go to a spit on any night, no matter what night it was, and not hear that twice a night.
We were told by many people in our organization that Lonely Hearts would never get played, never sell because it was too aggressive, it was too punk.
Too fast. Hard to mix. When I had to mix that in the clubs, I had to find stuff to mix that out of. And that's a pretty high BPM, my friend.
It's pretty fast. But yes, we were happy that it got the response that it got. And I remember taking cartons of the single in my car, in the trunk of my car, and going around to, you know, Rocket Records and Newbury Comics and selling the thing out of the back of my car because that's what you had to do those days. But luckily, Boston Radio was very, very supportive. And they picked
how many units of that sold, the original single?
Was it 6,000?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
That's impressive for a local record, 5,000, though.
Well, we actually stopped pressing it because we were going for another deal.
Right.
We were trying to get another deal, and we didn't want to sell 10,000 of them. And, you know,
exactly.
We wanted to try to make it at least a little bit, you know, where people would have a need to buy it.
Right.
I'm going to just go completely. This is like the out of order hour. Mm-hmm. Band name.
Yeah.
The Atlantics.
That guy thought, Tom thought that up.
I was walking along College Ave one day at Tufts University and it popped into my head.
And that was it.
And that was it. And I told Bobby and Bruce and they said, great, that's it. But, you know, aside from that, I think we liked it because it sort of highlighted that Boston-London kind of connection. Atlantics sounds big. But it sounds, you know, stormy and powerful. And so there's images that go along with it that we thought were very appealing.
Best bill you ever played on other than Roxy Music, when and where, or most unusual or strangest, or what the hell am I doing?
You've asked about four different questions there.
Yeah, I know.
Yes, I know.
There's
I want
best,
them all.
Most unusual, strangest, scariest.
I want them all. I want them all. Give them all
Fred,
to me.
Fred, you do one.
Well, okay.
Fred
I think maybe I'll tell you, we did a lot of concert work over the years. We opened from everybody from Prince to Boston we did a lot of road work. But the most difficult show we did was opening for Foreigner. Now, you'd think that this would be a bunch of people with cigarette lighters and, you know, but they weren't. There was at this club called the Cape, well, a concert hall called the Cape Cod Coliseum. It was this metal box with no ventilation. It was at the end of the summer. We pulled in and it was like a war zone. They served beer there. for 2 hours before we went on, people were standing in the stifling heat drinking beer. And by the time we hit the stage, all they wanted was Foreigner, and they couldn't have cared less who we were.
Did they have the cage, or did they not?
It was my Animal House question.
They didn't have the cage.
No cage. But they
threw...
Regular
Coliseum kind of setup.
They threw...
Oh, so it had the... Oh, jeez.
Yeah. They, they threw everything at us. They threw sneakers. They threw quarters. They threw bottles. They threw everything.
And they had trajectory power because of the raked seating.
Yep. Yeah. And, no, it was open floor. It was open in the floor. Everybody was standing up.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and
well,
it was
probably
stadium.
Not. They were probably doing this.
Oh, man. It was brutal. And B got hit off the forehead with a nip bottle. And ended up taking, what, 3 stitches in the forehead?
Yeah, and they were at Cape Cod Hospital, had to whisk him away to the
wild.
Hospital and get him stitched up.
And that was only beat by the time we opened for Alice Cooper, and a biker threw a full bottle of Bacardi rum at me and sailed past my head about a half an inch.
You got a drink on the way?
Now, you can imagine opening for Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
In 1980, it's like, my God, what are we doing here? What is going on?
He weighed about 85 pounds.
And the audience, I mean, who would pay good money to see Alice Cooper in 1980?
Bikers. I'm trying to think.
What kind of mentality would it take?
1980, because Only Women Bleed, which was probably his last
it was
single,
a long
was
time.
77.
It was a long time.
That was 77, if my memory serves me correctly.
Yes.
So.
Oh, yeah.
So he had nothing.
These were the diehard fans.
He had nothing. He was in Phoenix trying to golf.
And they were in an ugly mood. They were in an ugly mood, these guys.
He was. By then, he was trying to golf.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He was golfing and drinking Bud.
He became a Republican.
He had a few other interests besides.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so we had some challenging audiences who were...
But you take a good one.
Well, the Prince show.
Yeah, that was a good one.
We were hired to play with Prince. It was one of... It was his... what was the album?
Dirty Mind.
Yeah. At Metro, now Avalon.
Right.
On St. Patrick's Day in 1980, I don't know, two or so, something like that. And we thought this could be a big, big problem because it was St. Patrick's Day. It was Prince. There had been very few African-American concerts in Boston since Rick James tried to do it and couldn't do it because there were racial problems. So we thought this might be a very serious problem, this concert. But, you know, we're all Prince fans. So, you know, off we went, and we arrived there and watched his sound check and saw he was very professional, and we were looking forward to it. And also, one of the things that we tried to do with Lonely Hearts, one of the goals we had with Lonely Hearts, was to try to bridge this gap between white radio and black dance clubs.
Right.
We were really happy that Lonely Hearts got a great response in African-American dance clubs in Boston. So we were thrilled to be on the Prince bill. So we got up there, and we started doing our set. And I remember distinctly in front of me on, you know, stage right where I am, in the first couple rows were these beautifully dressed African-American ladies, probably about 35 years old, waiting for Prince, just smiling up at me. And I thought, okay, well, let's see what happens. Let's see how we do with them. And they thought we were great. They were so nice. They loved us. The audience loved us. It was a great audience. It was mixed black and white people together. No problems. It was a huge thrill, and for me, I think for all of us, it was a great accomplishment and great...
So it can happen.
It did happen, and it can happen. We had a great time. There's no problems. Prince put on a great show. Mm. So we really accomplished...
You never know.
You never know.
You never know.
And it was very gratifying to have that kind of experience.
So on a serious note, you lost members of the band that are now no longer with us.
Yes.
So is that what prompted you... I mean, what prompted you to put out the CD? What I mean, because this all of this music has been laying, I don't want to say dormant,
right?
But I'll
start it off and you guys can pick it up.
Right.
What literally happened in, I don't know, it was like 2003 or something, a couple of years ago, I had a call from a guy named Gary Boris in New York, and he was a fan of the band, and he's a nice guy, and he got a hold of me and said, Tom, how come you guys aren't putting out a CD of all your stuff? And I said, I don't know. And he goes, come on, you got to do it. I said, okay, well, we'll think about it. And so I called these guys up and called Paul Caruso. And sure enough, when the band folded its tent in 1983, I put all the tapes I had in a trunk, in a steamer trunk, all the photographs, everything, and sent them to my parents' home in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh my goodness! My next question is where all this stuff was.
They put it in the basement, climate-controlled basement. Thank God.
Wow.
And so, and there they sat. And over the years, I had played the songs now and then, and I felt that they really stood the test of time, that they weren't dated. They really sounded strong next to bands that were coming out, Blink-182, Green Day, you know, all the other power pop bands. And so I sent for the trunk, contacted these guys, and started putting this thing into motion.
And the tapes were indeed in...
salvageable, and they were indeed in the trunk. And the next step was to have them digitized.
Right.
I actually said that, digitized.
Digitized,
tough
yes.
to say. And Paul Caruso at that time had a fabulous studio on the South Shore, was working with Joe Perry from Aerosmith. He was well into the music business, so he took over the job of the tape salvaging.
And were these the original? What was it back then? Were these 16-track, 24-track?
It was a motley.
Well, at that point, we hadn't found the 16-track tapes, so the 24-track tapes. All we had was the
two-track mixes.
The master tapes. Mm-hmm. Right. And Paul baked them and he digitized them and he brought them sort of into sounding more modern. We all still play.
Exactly.
You know, Ray and I have a band called The Illegals, and Tom is still very active. And you know, it's really just a question of. Rock and roll is about your heart. It's about whether or not you feel like you want to plug that guitar in and still crank that volume up and step on the stage and really lay it down. Link Wray died a year or two ago. He was 76 or 77, still touring.
Okay? Exactly.
So, I mean, is there a point where you potentially move past the point where you should be out there? Yeah, maybe.
When you actually have so much arthritis you can't play.
Exactly. I think in the Atlantics also, the one thing that I gleaned from the band immediately when I joined it was that it's all about, everything was about the song. There wasn't any ego involved in terms of, how long is the guitar solo or who plays what part or do I drop out in this part and then play later. It's all about the song and the arrangements I think that we put together were unusual, and they really brought forward the best interest of the song and selling the song as an entity.
So we've created this little trademark we call a musical sandwich. And what it is, and you have a choice, you can do a club. You can do two or three of your songs as the bread. And then I want you to give me songs by other artists in between.
It sounds to me like Teenage Flu was influenced by Summertime Blues.
Which, and Eddie Cochran? Who? Blue Cheer?
I don't know which version, but...
Pick one. Don't leave it to me. I'm dangerous.
Oh, okay.
Eddie Cochran.
Eddie Cochran.
I was hoping we were going there, but you never know.
I'll give you one right off the top of my head. Lonely Hearts and Homicide by 999. Personality Crisis, New York Dolls.
Radio, Elvis Costello.
Okay.
Mission Impossible, Perfect Stranger.
Sheena's a punk rocker, Ramones.
Okay, how about I need a girl, and I want to be your dog, of the Stooges.
When you're young and boys keep swinging.
We David Bowie was at the first concert we did with Roxy Music at the Palladium in New York City. And he's apparently known for lifting stuff. So, about a year or two later, he came out with Boys Keep Swinging, and I still remember Ken Shelton at BCM playing When You're Young and Boys Keep Swinging and asking the audience if they saw any similarities.
And, you know, I was the only one that went down into the dressing room after the first show that we did.
Yeah.
Nobody else wanted to go. I don't know why. But I went down there, and David Bowie was there. And he said, I especially like the song When You're Young. He remembered it.
And there you go.
I cannot imagine.
And so, months later, there it was.